Welcome to the show. On today's episode, I'm joined by the love engineer himself, Alan Watts. Alan is a relationship coach who helps single men and women, along with couples, to navigate the world of love and relationships. And he knows a thing or two about it, having navigated a marriage breakup and refound love with a new partner. He's also written a book or two on the subject and recently started his own podcast. Expect to hear what Alan went through when his marriage broke down and what he did to overcome it. Why he believes that every experience we have that we don't want is a learning experience. How jumping from one relationship to another for purely physical reasons lacks the deep connection that we so desperately crave, and why inner work and healing is imperative. The necessary work you must do in the aftermath of marriage breakdown to find our true identity and who me is. The interplay between masculine and feminine in all of us, and why polarity is important in relationships to attract men and women. Why accepting the relationship has ended and taking your responsibility for the part you played is key, and how expecting your partner to communicate like a man is the biggest mistake men make. There are a few ways you can get involved with the show. Firstly, you can follow me on X, formerly Twitter. Secondly, you can hit subscribe and share on your favourite podcast player. Or if you like to watch stuff, check the show out on YouTube. And thirdly, subscribe to my free newsletter called The Journey. You can find the link to this in the episode show notes. I'm pretty excited by the journey as I share with you regularly what I have learned and continue to learn on my own journey. And now to my conversation with Alan. I have brought you on to speak about something that's kind of quite specific this evening. And I know you've got stories to tell anyway. And that subject is dating after divorce or separation. Before we get into the kind of meat of the podcast as such, can you tell me a bit about yourself and your story and how you came to be what you've called yourself nowadays, which is the love engineer?
It's the questions I get asked quite a bit. Like, firstly, what the hell's a love engineer anyway? And secondly, how do you end up doing that? What did you do before? All those kind of things. So first question I'm going to answer is what I did before, which was I was a truck mechanic. So why do I do what I do? And a lot of it goes back to what you could call the defining moments about, 10, 12 years ago now, where I found myself on the living room floor of what was my family home, bawling my eyes out, having gone through a divorce, another relationship breakdown afterwards, living in a house I couldn't afford to keep up the mortgage payments on, couldn't afford to sell. I was full-time in my own business, but the income was only from a part-time business. So it's like, now what? And for some reason, you know, sort of looking back over my life and sort of growing up on the farm, not being good with people and being bullied in school, having one of my best mates die when we were in school, the family farm being sold when I was 13. So that was my future, my dreams, everything sold out from underneath my feet by my family, as if I didn't matter at all, kind of thing. And marrying a lovely lady, we just didn't get on. And it turned out that she was potentially a narcissist, certainly had all the traits, and certainly a lot of lies, deceit. She told me she was working as a waitress. It turned out it was more like, never mind, it's food spread on a table. It's probably more likely her legs, but that's another story. And I got conned into having IVF with her, partly because she was Chinese, where we had that done. I thought it was a sexual health clinic in China. It wasn't. So I was in a mess. And there was part of me that wanted to end my life at that time. But having been down that road before, having had family members go down that road, it wasn't an option. So it's like, now what? What can I do? I can sell whatever I've got left and disappear to New Zealand, start again. And it was very tempting. And Tony Robbins talks about these 2 millimeter shifts that change your life. Well, that 2 millimeter shift was putting on a CD. So I've always been a music fan. So for some reason, while I was thinking about the Southern Hemisphere, put on these a couple of CDs I was given while I was over there by a guy called Mike Tramp. First song that hit me was "You Can Take My House, You Can Take My Fancy Car, You Can Take the Bed I'm Sleeping, But You Can Never Take My Rock and Roll." That hit me. So I put on the other CD, and then there's a song on that one that says, "Is he better off now that his father is dead? His mother was never what a mother should be." And it's like, is this guy singing about my kids in the future? Damn. And it's like, that was the flight to New Zealand just cancelled in a heartbeat. So it's like, what do I do now? But I made that decision that whatever it took, I had to be the dad that my kids needed to be. I had to be the man that I needed to be. I just didn't know how. So that kind of set me on a journey of self-discovery, even though I was already into personal development, most of it was up there. And so I hired a coach. I went to Tony Robbins's Unleash the Power Within. And things started to change a little bit. And a few months later, I shut my business down after I'd got myself to a position where I've got the legal stuff sorted with a divorce. So I had control over how much money she could get from me. And I went and got a job back in the motor trade. Didn't really want to do it, but it meant I could get back to some kind of even and build from there. And I spent 10 years going on just about every course I could, every book I could read, you name it, I did it. And I found myself in a few Facebook groups, and for single people that were committed to having great relationships, and people started asking me for advice. And what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And they'd say, are you a coach? Like, no, why would I want to be a coach? And look, and then that happened quite a few times. And it's like, okay, look through the Facebook friends, it's like coach, 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 coach. Nah, there's no point. Market saturated. And had a, shall we say, personal experience with a young lady, and it's like, I can't really describe that moment, but it's like, okay, if I had some coaching skills right now, I could handle this totally differently. So I went and did a coaching course, mainly so I could guide or help partners that I was dating, which is never actually a good idea, it turns out. And I thought it might help me as a dad coach my kids and bring out the best in them as well. And sort of coaching people online in my spare time, which I really enjoyed. And then I found myself on a spiritual retreat, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago now. And there was two things that came out of that retreat. One we might talk about a bit later. And the name, The Love Engineer. I was talking to one of the facilitators, asked over breakfast, so what do you do, Alan? I said, well, I was a truck mechanic, but I'm learning to be a relationship coach. He just sat there and kind of looked up at the sky, and I'm thinking, oh, God, what have I said? He's going to tell me not to bother or something like that.
I bet that's the first time around. He's ever heard someone say that, ever.
Yeah, and he just, from truck engineer to love engineer. And I thought, I love that name. So, yeah, that's how the name of The Love Engineer was born. And, that's kind of how we are up to date.
And that's how things evolved and developed. And so when your kind of marriage fell apart and stuff, did you, what was your path? Did you kind of take a break before you got into new relationships, or how did that kind of play out for you? Because I know that, this kind of in the aftermath is a real feature that guys go through in terms of, you know, should I make up for lost time? Should I play the field? I think some guys often go a little bit crazy. And I've spoken to men that I know who have separated and divorced, and they maybe go through a bit of a hedonistic time, dating apps, one night stands, you know, you name it. And then they're kind of like, actually, that was fun, but it also was kind of like a form of an escapism where they just really didn't know what to do, and it wasn't actually making them happy doing that either. Is that something you experienced, or is that something that comes up commonly amongst guys that are going through this?
Yeah, I think in some ways at different times throughout that first couple of years, I did all that. So when the actual separation was effectively me coming home to an empty house and not knowing where she was, not knowing where the kids were, anything like that, which kind of put the final nail in the coffin of my own self-confidence at that time. That was November 2010, and actually started my first relationship after that in, I think it was about October 2011.
Okay.
So it's nearly 2 years. But it took me a while to actually be any kind of ready. There's an old saying that says, time heals. And whilst that may be true, it's only partially true, because it's what you do with the time that heals. You can either sit and wait for all the feelings to suppress and then pretend they're not there and go out and do whatever you want, or ignore them and go straight out and do whatever you want. And what I find the best is to actually learn from the process, because every experience we have that we don't want is a learning experience, but we've got to be prepared to face it and go inside and find out what that lesson is.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like what you're saying is that there is like a balance between finding yourself again, but also experiencing the full force of the pain from the relationship ending and allowing yourself to recover from that.
Yeah, because there's always that, I'm not sure if it's the ego or the monkey mind or just what we have between our legs, but there's that, always that thing that says, I'm single again now, I'm going to go and find another one. The only thing is, what I find when we do things like that is you might get the physical stuff, but it's not fulfilling. If you want a fulfilling, lasting relationship and a healthy relationship, you have to grow yourself to the level where you can actually have that relationship.
Yeah. And does that, when you are doing that, I'm guessing that that enables you to have a lot deeper, more fulfilling connection than a very surface level, fleeting, in lust rather than in love. Would that be accurate to say?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And when you, and when this, like one of the things that I've observed, and this is anecdotally, with guys, and funny enough, I was talking to some guys the other week about this, is that like marriage is defined as the voluntary union of man and woman to the exclusion of all others. And I think that people misinterpret this word union. And what I've noticed is for guys that have been in relationships for some years, there is this kind of, instead of it being a union, i.e. two individuals with their own autonomy going on a journey together, often what happens is there is this kind of like merging together, morphing together as one.
Yeah.
And what happens is the, you know, the guy will often, you know, he'll stop seeing his friends, he'll stop doing his hobbies, he'll stop doing his all the things that made him him and all the things that kind of attracted him to her in the first place. So they both almost become lost. And when I see guys that are separated and are going through a divorce, there is this kind of, there's this grieving of the marriage breakdown and the relationship breakdown, but there is also this rediscovery of themselves, this individuality and the autonomy and what they like and what their needs are and who, what sort of people they want to hang out with and what sort of hobbies they want to do and maybe even what impact they want to have on the world. And all, so all of a sudden, all this stuff that they've kind of been suppressing for a long, long time suddenly comes out of the bag again. And it's like, hang on a minute, who am I? What do I want? And is there a process that guys can go through to in order to begin to kind of tease some of this stuff out? And is there questions that they should ask of themselves to really nail some of this stuff down, Alan?
First thing I'll say with that, with suppressing your own hobbies and stuff like that, guilty as charged. I did it. And in some ways, it goes back to that saying of happy wife, happy life, which is a load of bollocks. Because I used to play hockey every week, train on Wednesday night, match on a Saturday. She says that was too expensive, so I stopped doing that. And then stopped going out with my mates and pretty much stopped drinking, stopped almost everything. And at one point, she even told me that I should sell my electric guitar. I'm like, no. But you don't play it very often. Yeah, because I'm always working to pay the bills. I'm not selling it. I'd rather get rid of you, which didn't go down very well.
I wonder why.
Yeah. I don't think any time I spoke my truth with her, it went down well. But, so that's part of what I talked about with the journey within. Because one of the things I did on, it wasn't straight away, it was a bit farther down the line. I looked myself in the mirror and said, right, who the fuck are you? And the first answer that says, I'm Alan. Okay, that's my name. Who is Alan? Oh, I'm a mechanic. I'm this, I'm that. And all these different labels come out. And pull all these things apart so there's just me looking at me in the mirror. And it's like, if my body dies, I disappear out of that body. The life disappears. The body dies, but I don't. So, okay, I must be some kind of energy force or life energy living in this body, or a spirit, if you like. So, okay, if I'm a spiritual being that cannot die, I'm having a human experience. Firstly, if I've got more freedom when I'm dead, because I'm not confined to this body, why am I here? And that was, it's like, if I didn't have a physical body, what would music sound like? What would it smell like to smell a flower? What would sex feel like? What would it be like? How would we know what it's like to create another life? But who am I? And digging past all that crap, it's like, half of this shit doesn't matter. It's not me. So that also means I can create who me is. And that took me back to an interview I heard a while back with the late guitarist Steve Clark from Def Leppard. And he said, when a lot of people play guitar, they want to play like Jimi Hendrix. So they learn every Jimi Hendrix song and they play just like Jimi. They have the same guitar, the same amp, play it the same way. He said, that's not the way to get into a band. He says, what you do is listen to take that bit from Jimi Hendrix, that bit from Jimmy Page, that bit from Gary Moore, that bit from here, that bit from there, put it all into a box and mix it up and put that out for your own personal expression. And you can do that the same in life or in a relationship. What do I want in this relationship? How do I want to show up? Who's having the kind of relationships that I want? ah, that guy over there, I take that bit. I like that bit of the earlier me, so I'll put that in there. That bit from my dad, that bit from maybe a movie star or something, and put it all in together like a cake and mix it up, and then decide how you move forward from there. Because at the end of the day, every relationship you go to, you take me, myself, and I with you.
That's really deep, that. And I think it's interesting because there is a mask, I think, that goes on men when they go into a relationship as well. So there is not just the kind of sacrifices that are made in order to make the relationship work, or maybe the more accurate word to describe it is to make the relationship stick. But I think there is also a mask that goes on in terms of, right, I've met this really cool person that I want to spend some time with, and therefore I need to kind of keep up this veneer and this mask and this perfection that that sometimes becomes quite crushing to maintain. What I notice in people where people have been together for a long time, you cannot sustain that. So you know your wife will begin to, she'll know how you respond to things. She'll know you kind of, you know, she's the one person that you spend the most time with, more so than anyone else. So it's impossible to keep up that veneer. And I think that, it becomes unstuck a little bit, because when you mix this kind of mask in with the fact that you're making all these sacrifices and you're losing yourself, all of a sudden you can quite quickly become a stranger to who you're with and begin to really question who you are. And I think, like some guys have this realization, I think, before the relationship ends. Some guys have it after the relationship has ended, and some guys maybe don't even have that that realization at all, which brings me on to my next question. How do guys prevent relationship number two becoming a repeat of marriage number one? I've learned nothing. I'm just going to carry on operating as I am, completely oblivious to all of this stuff, you know?
Yeah. The first thing you do is blame your previous partner for it. And the partner before that, and the partner for that, and before that, the partner before the back. Question: what is the common link between all those partners? It's that man in the mirror. And it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. The way I look at the whole dating world, and this may ruffle a few feathers, there are three approaches to dating relationships. On one side, you've got the suppressing, where you feel like you're not good enough, and that mask of not being good enough is the one you take into the relationship, and you ignore your own boundaries. Everything's about your partner, and it's like the old lose-win idea from Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and ultimately they're just screaming out, "Love me." And then
this is the archetypal nice guy.
Yeah. And then on the other flip side of that, there's another mask. The one where they puff the chest out, they talk as if they're the best thing since sliced bread, a little bit like Donald Trump or Andrew Tate. And this mask is like, I am going to win, and I don't care if you lose or not. It's a very much a win-lose scenario, and it just screams out, respect me, respect what I do. And then in between those two minefields, there's a thin path of sincerity where you take the masks off and put your true self out there, and that filters out all the potential partners that are not in alignment. It's a very scary thing to do, but before you can do that, you have to know who the fuck you are.
And this, and do you know what, as well, as you were saying that, it really echoes what I was talking about with Adam Lane Smith a couple of episodes back. That kind of nice guy being the anxious attachment, and then that guy that really, yeah, really couldn't give a fuck is avoidant. So as far as the avoidant guys, the guy with avoidant attachment style is concerned, everything is going fine and dandy, and it's a shock when all of a sudden he comes home and his wife's left his bags in his clothes in a bin liner by the front door. He's just not seen it coming.
Yeah. No, I think I was actually a combination of the two.
Yeah.
I kind of went from one to the other, whether it's between relationships or even in my marriage. I was probably a bit of both. The only person I wasn't is that sincere, composed, confident, authentic me.
Yeah. Interesting. And I think as well, like, when I was talking to Adam Lane Smith previously, we were talking about this, the kind of nice guy and the anxious attachment style. I wonder how much of that is actually influenced by, you know, the baby boomer generation the example that a lot of guys of our generation have seen, which is the kind of very sort of passive aggressive man that, you know, yes, dear, no, dear, three bags full, dear, anything for a quiet life. And bends over backwards to not communicate his needs or actually say anything when he's upset. But then there's this massive explosion when he gets, you know, and it's, again, Robert Glover talks about the fact that often these guys have low-level depression, addictions, habits, you know, and they're leading this whole secret life, completely secret from their partners, that where they're just not, because there's a fear there that if they communicate their needs, then they're going to be rejected, and that they're not going to be, if they're rejected, then they get left alone and abandoned, and all of a sudden, you know, the whole thing goes full circle. Yeah. And it's, I think, one of the things I've noticed with guys in particular is actually giving them the empowerment to actually speak up, and not speak up in a like a rude or an aggressive way, but actually just purely and simply state their needs and state what they want, and stop being frightened of doing that, and stop being frightened that their wife is going to leave them if they have the audacity to, like, think, when you think about that logically, what kind of relationship is it that you're in that you have this primal fear that if you actually say anything that's going to upset your wife, that she could like, when you think about that, that's bizarre. Like, even looking at as an outsider in, you're like, actually, that's just mental. Like, what kind of, and I was talking to someone recently, this is quite funny, about how it's portrayed in the media that we're living in a patriarchal society at the moment, or not necessarily the media, but certain elements. And yet much of the stories that I hear from within intimate relationships would indicate the opposite, that actually there is a very matriarchal dynamic that's taking place in a lot of intimate relationships, which would surprise, I think, a lot of people, because it's a very taboo subject to talk about, stuff like coercive control and that kind of thing.
Yeah, because if I remember correctly, a patriarchy is where there's structure and order, and whether we look at society in general or most relationships, there's no structure, there's no order, it's just all over the place, which would make it more matriarchy. But no one wants to admit that, do they?
No. It's a very taboo subject. And I think the thing is that when we get into these subjects, they're so mired in ideology, gender critical theory, and all this kind of stuff, which really kind of detracts from, like, when we were kids, there was the rhyme, wasn't there? Girls are sugar and spice and all things nice, and boys are slugs and snails and puppy dogs' tails. And I think that whilst that seems kind of quite lighthearted, I think that that forms a lot of the belief systems that men have in terms of how they should approach and perceive women. But as any man will tell you who has been on this planet for a few decades, women and men have the ability to exert power in nefarious ways. They might do it in different ways, and they might do it using a manner of different techniques, but they still exert power, particularly in intimate relationships, in as equal measure as one another. And that's a really kind of controversial thing for a man to come out with, but it does happen. And I think that we should be able to discuss stuff like this. And let's be clear, we're not saying that all one woman is representative of all women, or one man is representative of all men. That's not what we're saying here. What we're saying here is that both sexes have the capacity to behave in a malevolent way towards their partners if and when they want to. So, and that's just taking the veneer off what we learn in this whole sugar and spice and all things nice and slugs and snails and puppy dogs tales.
Yes, it's what comes up for me when we talk about this stuff is the masculine and feminine energies, which I know you went into very deeply with John Gray. And I find there's this illusion that people have that you've got to be masculine or feminine, but we're both. We are both. If anyone tries to block out their feminine energy, they end up on that, wearing that mask of I'm better than everyone else and trying to control everything, which comes from fear. And the resistance of the feminine also creates the resistance to their own feminine energy. So they've got no connection to their emotions. They've got no empathy. They've got no compassion. It's all about them in a way. There's no connection. But then on the flip side, if you've got resistance to the masculine, then it's all about manipulation and trying to control, because you want to control your feelings, but you want to try and twist and turn the other person to react a certain way, neither of which is healthy. And at the same time, if me and my partner are both 50% masculine, 50% feminine, there's no polarity there. There's no attraction. So I reckon that the guys need to be 70% masculine, 30% feminine, and women need to be the opposite. And then you've got that polarity, and you've got that balance between the two. The masculine one still has a connection to the emotions, and the feminine one still has a connection to their masculine, which they need for fight or flight. Otherwise, they become really needy and a doormat, which, again, isn't healthy. But then as individuals outside of that relationship, then having that balance, 50-50 balance, can be a good thing, but not within that relationship, because you need that polarity and you need that opposite attraction for the passion, but the intimacy. Otherwise, I suppose you're just good friends.
Mm. And David Dada talks about this, doesn't he? How when you get that masculine and feminine dynamic, it's complementary and it acts like, you know, a magnet. It's like magnetism. So it attracts rather than repels. Whereas when the masculine and feminine energies are all out of whack, it's like the, you know, two poles of a magnet pushing one another apart. So, that's a very good point on that side of things. And I think it's something that kind of gets missed, particularly in the workplace as well, because I know I've heard said before that one of the dynamics that is quite tricky to navigate is when you have a woman that is in a kind of a high-powered leadership position then coming home and spending time with her husband, but she's still in that taking on quite a few masculine characteristics, and then it actually repels him and they end up arguing.
In those situations, two things need to happen. One, he's got to be in his masculine to provide that safe space for her to be feminine, and she's got to be willing to go to that feminine place. It's a two-way street. We've both got to work together.
Yeah, which takes awareness on both parts as well.
Yeah.
And a willingness to actually do that. But a lot of people aren't tuned into this, are they? I think it's very kind of, people still find it very, very woo-woo until you actually practice it and you're like, actually, this feels completely natural. There's a lot more harmony in our relationship and the attraction levels are skyrocketing.
Yeah, something my good lady said it was a couple of months ago now, and we're just lying in bed drifting off to sleep, and she says, I've just realized something. With all this masculine and feminine stuff that you keep talking about, when I think to like the Native American tribes, the men are the masculine ones and the women are the feminine. And it works. They don't have the arguments that we do have in the Western world. I said, funny that, isn't it? There's when I was in my marriage, I would have been probably the more feminine one, and she was more masculine. And when my lady was married to her husband, she was the more masculine one. He was the more feminine one. And when we came to this relationship, I was like, that ain't happening.
Yeah, it sounds like it's made a massive difference by the sounds of things as well.
Yeah, definitely. I've lost count of the number of times he keeps saying, oh, she's too so unemotional and all this, that, and the other. I'm thinking, hang on a minute. I don't know how many times she's been in tears on my shoulder the last month. It's like, dude, it's how you show up that makes that difference.
Yes, that is a massive difference, isn't it? When you say it like that, it is a big difference.
Yeah.
What do you think that that divorce and separation actually do to a man's confidence deep down? Because like a lot of guys say to me, oh, it just shattered their confidence, and you know, they just feel worthless and cast aside, and you know, they really question where their purpose lies. And what do you think that does to a man's confidence, Aaron?
Well, society has programmed us men that we are the leaders of the household. If she's not happy, it's our fault. If we're not happy, it's our fault. And there's a naval term that the captain goes down with a ship. In this case, it just happens to be a relationship.
I like that. I like that.
And once you've gone down, you've got two options: swim for your life or drown.
Yeah, it's a very profound way.
Or sit and wait for a shark.
Yeah, sit and wait for a shark. And in terms of like regaining their confidence, is there things that guys can do to begin to lighten the load on their shoulders, so to speak, to get their confidence back when it feels like the whole kind of world has ended? And to a certain extent, it has ended if they've been invested in a relationship for many years.
Well, the first thing, accept that it's finished and it's never not going to go back to the way it was. Occasionally, there are those that separate. He goes back to how he was. She goes back to how she was. And again, that polarity and the opposites are there. Sometimes that happens. Not very often. Once that divorce has gone through, very rare do people get married again to the same person. So the first thing is accept it's happened and learn from it. As much as we would like to say it's all her fault. It ain't. There is a lot of stuff that we do, even if it's unconscious, that contributes to that relationship breaking down. It takes two to make a relationship work, but it takes two to fuck it up.
So it's a very bitter pill to swallow. Yeah, so it's recognition of that fact. And how? And if your ex-wife has not really said too much, like sometimes I think with one of the things that men find tricky with women is that sometimes women don't always give a lot away, and they don't necessarily communicate clearly what it is that is the kind of problem. And so guys often end up in this kind of like, you know, that game that you had when you were kids, Guess Who, where you'll get, it's like a guessing game. So what does she like?
Yeah.
What does she mean by that? This is a bit cryptic. How do you actually get to the bottom of this stuff if your ex-partner or ex-wife has been not that forthcoming with what actually you went wrong or what you did wrong? Is it a case that you have to kind of tease over some of the kind of clues that maybe they dropped and some of the things they said or some of the things they suggested?
Was three S's that come to mind, and these are actually really good keys if you're getting to know a lady as well, and if you're in a relationship with her, and if you're broken up, that relationship's broken up. These three S's that they need. They need to feel safe, they need to feel special, and they need to feel seen. If she's scared that you're going to lose your rag at any given moment, she's not going to feel safe to express the full story. And neither would we. And if she doesn't feel seen, what's the point in talking anyway? And I know there'd be a lot of guys who relate to this, because how often do we feel seen in a relationship anyway? When we're on the receiving end and feeling seen and feeling safe, it's so much easier to communicate our truth. And it's the same for women. They want to feel heard. And so often in the terms of relationships breaking down, it's broken down because one or other either doesn't feel safe, doesn't feel special, or doesn't feel seen.
Reverse engineering that. I am guessing that a man is therefore going to have to do some work, or at least take some degree of responsibility insofar as developing emotional intelligence going forward.
Yeah.
Listening skills going forward.
Let me just
clarify that a bit more. Deep listening skills going forward as opposed to surface listening skills. And we might actually delve into that, I suppose. And actually the ability to validate what their partner is actually going through. Sounds to me like those three things are going to be key in them rehabilitating themselves going forward.
Yeah. And the other thing that goes back to what John Gray talks about, don't expect her to communicate like a man. It ain't happening. Learn her communication style.
Yeah. I had a guest on the podcast, you may remember him a while back, Oscar Trimboli, and I never forget what he said to me. He was working with a guy on deep listening skills. And when I talk about deep listening skills, I don't mean like just listening to what she's saying and going, yeah, whatever. Actually really listening to what she's saying and asking questions about what she's saying and actually noticing what's unsaid as well. This is like an advanced skill. Anyway, Oscar had been working with this guy for a little while, and this guy contacted him and he said, look, my wife's accused me of having an affair. And he was like, and Oscar was like, well, what do you mean? And he was like, well, she said she kind of confronted me about it, and she said, look, come on, come out with it. I know you've been having an affair. And he was like, well, No, I've not been having an affair or anything. She's like, come on, it's easier if you just kind of tell me and just be upfront with me or whatever. He's like, look, I've not been having an affair. I've been working with this guy, Oscar, on my listening skills for the last, I think, 3 months, I think it was. And And the wife was like astonished. She was like, "Oh, I felt closer to you. I felt this and I felt that." She felt, and they'd been having, you know, I think they'd been having unbelievable sex as well. So, and all of this was from nothing else but the fact that he'd been cultivating deep listening skills for 3 months. So, to highlight what you've just said, these things, like, I think when we were, I did a, I've got a newsletter going out to my mailing list tomorrow on this particular subject. And like when we're young men, you know, you read in the pages of FHM or Lowly or whatever it is, you know, 10 ways to get your wife, your girlfriend sexy or to turn your woman on or the rest of it and stuff. But in actual fact, they never mention the fact that this stuff that you do outside.
They never mention anything that works.
No, they never mention anything worse, but they don't mention these kind of, what I would call non-intimate forms of communication, and these, no, it's not really non-intimate forms of communication. It's non-sexual intimacy, basically. They never mention any of this in anything you read, but these are really sort of simple but very advanced skills that you can learn. They're totally learnable skills that you can learn.
Yeah, but another thing which I found is connected to the listening skills, and when she's feeling safe, seen, and special, she feels safe enough to be herself within that relationship. As a result of that, those barriers that women have before that sexual intimacy comes down, those barriers aren't there at all because of their safety. No. Quality of the intimacy goes up, the quality of the orgasm goes up, that depth of connection just keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper as long as you keep showing up.
Because they can be themselves. This is all really good stuff. So I've asked some of the guys in my community a few questions, actually, because there's a couple of the guys in there who recently separated. So you're going to get some questions from some of the guys that are actually in the Guild of Dad's Brotherhood. So this is unusual, but when I am coming into contact with chaps that are at the coalface of this, it's always useful to find out from them what are the kind of things that they want to know. So one of the things that came up was, when is the right time to start dating after divorce or separation? We've kind of covered this, but is there a right time, Alan, or is it very...
It's... Subjective. I think it's a very individual thing, because if you don't feel ready, it ain't time. If you haven't been inside and looked at yourself and looked on your part of that relationship breakdown, it's too soon. Because otherwise, you're just going to have the same kind of relationship with a different face. Yeah, there's going to be that fun, exciting time in the beginning, and then the masks fall off. Or you're going to get into that new relationship and she's going to be poking all these wounds that you didn't even know were there.
Okay.
And you attach those wounds with her, and it's got absolutely nothing to do with her. It's just because you haven't healed.
So you're rewriting history. So the stuff that we've discussed earlier on in this conversation, do the inner work, uncover some of this.
Absolutely.
This stuff that you need to get clear on in terms of your individuality, what you want, and be very clear on that and very comfortable in that before you embark on anything else. Okay.
I see a lot of dating coaches that say, well, who is your ideal partner? And then what do you need to do to attract those? Which is a recipe for disaster. The question is, who do you want to be in that relationship? Is that who you are today? No. Then build up yourself up to that point. And then when you're there, then say, okay, who's going to be attracted to this man? And then go find her.
I suppose if you're actually putting like a checklist together, you're actually projecting as well. You're projecting onto someone else rather than being yourself as well, aren't you?
Yeah. And so much of the dating world is the stuff above the water level of an iceberg. It's like, I want a similar sense of humor. I want same taste in music or same taste in movies or whatever. But then underneath that iceberg, you've got things like love languages, masculine, feminine polarity. You've got values and all these things. They're the things that need to be aligned. That's when people like themselves. But the opposites attract thing comes down to the energies.
Yeah. And funny enough, I was talking to someone about this. I think it was Animation, I think possibly on a previous podcast. And we were talking about, you know, this kind of checklist nature of the modern dating market and online and stuff and that. And I pointed out to her that sometimes it's kind of quite irrational. Attraction is quite irrational. And you might think, oh, yeah, I've got a certain type. But in actual fact, the woman that you end up really, really connected to is nothing like your type, so to speak. And I hear that countless times where guys I know that have been married for some time, and they're like, yeah, well, we weren't really kind of, I wasn't looking for something, she wasn't looking for anything, and then we just kind of, you know, we just got on and our values aligned, and, you know, we were on a similar page, and it was kind of, you know, the rest was history sort of thing. So I think a lot of the modern day, I know, well, you can listen to tons of podcasts about the problems in the modern dating market and stuff, but certainly I know from what I've been listening to recently that a lot of people are beginning to move away from dating apps and actually concentrate on real life face-to-face interactions with people.
Yeah.
Old school.
All the dating apps are really is saying, hello, I'm here. They're just say for raising awareness. But the trouble is when you get that awareness and you think, she's perfect match. How the fuck do you know? You've only seen a few pictures and a little bit of blurb. And how does she know the same with you?
It's like Deliveroo for romance, isn't it? Where you can just order whatever you want off the menu. But in actual fact, is that going to satiate you in the same way as something that's a lot more meaningful with a deeper connection, I guess?
Yeah. So if you think about it, you can put a roast dinner out of a packet into a microwave. It's done in 2 minutes. What's going to taste better, that or when you've taken the time to prepare a proper roast dinner?
I like that analogy. Yeah, I can do cooking analogies, but the problem is this time of night, it just gives me the munchies. That's the
thing. You start getting hungry.
So the other question that was asked is, how do you overcome the fear of having a serious romantic relationship? So, yeah, I think this speaks to what we were talking about before. When you've been really stung and really hurt, how do you overcome that fear of, you know, rejection and it not working out? And, how do you think you overcome that, Adam?
Firstly, look into what is behind that fear. Is it personal experience and unhealed wounds? Or is it the one that they talk about on the American dating podcasts and stuff, which is actually true over here as well, where the guy is supposed to pay for the dates, he's supposed to organize them, he's supposed to show up, he's supposed to drive, and then he's supposed to marry her, because if he doesn't marry her, he's not committed. And then if they have kids as well, she can then take the house, she can take the car, she can take the kids and live with nothing except the bills. And that's a very scary prospect, especially if you've been there before. And you can't guarantee that any other woman is never going to do that, but what you can do is work on yourself, get yourself to that point where you've got that quality relationship. Is especially if you're going to have kids. For a woman to leave the father of her kids, there's got to be something drastically wrong. That's one of the things I had to look at. So it's not an easy choice for them.
No. So really the answer is
do the inner work.
You have to do the inner work again before to overcome that fear of getting into another serious long-term relationship.
Yeah. And even when you've done the work, when you get into another relationship, you're going to get triggered because there's stuff on a deeper level that you have hasn't come up to the surface yet. And these wounds, if you like, don't get prodded or triggered with any other kind of relationship because there isn't that intimacy there. You can heal so much on your own, but then you find in a relationship, I need to work on that. That's an interesting feeling. Where's that come from? And look into that.
So look at it actually. So when you go into the next relationship, actually, when stuff comes up, look at it as an opportunity for self-exploration rather than an alarm bell going off that something is seriously wrong again.
Yeah. Obviously, have your clear boundaries. And when I look at boundaries, I look at like a traffic light system. So green is good for go. Amber, that's a bit questionable. And once the red, no, game over, goodbye.
Yeah. And so much of life comes down to boundaries as well, because I think that like one of the analogies I use for boundaries, particularly if a relationship has struggled with boundaries, is it's kind of like gates on a farmyard. Like if you've left the gates open on a farmyard and all the animals have been running riot for a long period of time, it's going to take quite a bit of effort to get them back in where they should be and then shut the gate. But once they're back in and you've shut the gate, then the boundary is back in place again. But I think that one thing I notice is that actual process of putting those boundaries back into place, you may well get some resistance and pushback if you're in an existing relationship. But I think that that applies to any relationship, that if there's not been a boundary and then you suddenly put up a boundary, it's like, hold on, where did this come from? I don't like that. Yeah. It's destabilized the relationship.
Yeah. Some of our boundaries are actually unconscious because nobody's got close to them yet. We don't know they're there.
That's a really good point. I'd not even thought about that one. Yeah, unconscious boundaries. So again, you're not going to know about unconscious boundaries until the alarm bell goes off that could be masquerading as an opportunity for a bit more inner work and insight. Okay, that makes perfect sense. This is a common one. And I see this actually on... I watch First Dates now and again, and I see this come up and I'm like... How soon and what is the best way to tell your new partner about the story of why you separated, if at all? Is it a need to know basis or?
That is a very good question. And I don't know if it's right. I don't know if it's wrong, but I told the partner I'm with now about it pretty early on. Because I was in a position where I had some of this so-called baggage, like a crazy ex. Like, if that's going to be a problem, I want to know now. I don't want to find out in 6 months' time. I want to know now. So I even gave her a copy of my book, which had most of the story in it as well. So I thought, well, I'm going to do everything I can to try and put her off. And it didn't work, which I see is a good sign. So... a lot of it depends on when you feel comfortable to do it, mainly. And it will also depend on what her previous experience was. Because I shared the story with someone else, had a first date with a few years ago, and having dinner, and I could sense something was off, but I couldn't tell what. So anyway, paid for it, and she went home, and I went home, and said, thank you for a great evening, but I can't see you again because what you were saying just reminded me of my ex. And I thought, next. You did me a favor. Great.
Yeah. 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 It makes sense because if you're going to want to know, you're going to want to know sooner rather than later. And I suppose it's just actually using a bit of kind of common sense and actually picking the right time in terms of actually, well, I'm not going to come out with this as like when we're in a busy place, it's finding a quiet place, I guess,
yeah,
where they're relaxed. You're already talking about other stuff anyway, and picking your kind of right time to actually do it rather than just blurting it out.
Yeah.
When you're in the, you know, when you're in the middle of dinner or there's other people around, and you know what I mean? So I guess it's just picking your moment. Yeah, okay. What about telling your kids and ex-partner about your new relationship?
Again, it's, there's no right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
For me, not long after we'd separated, I remember my kid's mum saying, telling me I could have a girlfriend, but I wasn't allowed to introduce her to the kids. And that was like red rag for a bull for me. So the next three girlfriends I met got introduced to the kids. But they were at that age where they wouldn't necessarily notice any kind of revolving doors of partners and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I only introduced them, my kids, to a partner I think or believe there is a chance they are going to be in the kids' lives for a long time.
Okay. And do you think that there is indicators that in your relationship that you can kind of look out for, your new relationship, you can kind of look out for in terms of your new partner being kind of cool with you introducing kids into the equation as well, sort of thing? Or it, let me put it more accurately, introducing the kids to the fact that you've got a new partner and they are that new partner?
Yeah. Well, to start with, you can introduce them to, as a friend,
mm-hmm.
and just build on that slowly and see how it goes. When me and my partner, we'd been together for, I think it's about 6 weeks, 2 months. We knew we were going to be together for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, with her kids being younger, having childminders is a bit, can be a bit of a pain in the rear end. So it was inevitable that they were going to meet me at some point. So one of the local social clubs had a karaoke night and family night. So we both went there individually, took our kids there, and everyone got on. So that was quite convenient.
Yeah, it sounds like it worked out quite well. One of the things that actually you just touched upon when you were replying to that last question was around boundaries, I think. And one thing that came up is what sort of boundaries do you need to put in place when it comes to your obligation to your kids versus telling your ex-wife about what is happening with your new partner? What I mean by this is actually you've mentioned that your ex-wife tried to control new partners / what you tell the kids about new partners, which is, again, it's kind of, for some guys, like you alluded to, it's them trying to get their claws into your life again and controlling what you do and what you don't do.
Yeah.
Boundaries around that, Alan, that's got to be a tricky one to navigate.
Yeah, definitely. And it all comes down to how amicable the relationship is between you and your ex, or you and the kid's mum.
Okay.
If it's like mine, not very amicable, and whatever I do, I'm going to be in the wrong, I might as well do what I want to do.
Hmm.
With the kid's best interests at heart.
Whereas if it's more amicable, then you can sort of say, look, I've got this new partner. Obviously, you've got to break it to the kids. How would you like to go about this if it's more amicable? And it may be that your ex-wife can prepare them for it, i.e. dad's got a new friend at the moment and stuff, and you can work together on it. And it may be then, but I guess there's a bit of meeting halfway in terms of coordinating how it's broken to the kids.
Yeah, because my lady sort of asked her ex-husband, I've got a new partner, do you want to meet him before he meets the kids?
That's a nice touch.
He's like, well, why would I want to do that? So,
but the point is, you offered it.
It's an individual thing.
But the point, and the point is, in offering it, it's actually, we've got nothing to hide. That's what that statement says. And yeah. if they don't want to take you up on it, then that's cool. The and mere also, act of offering it is.
Yeah. I think it was about a year ago now. We were going to theatre school performance that the kids were doing. So I sent a message to the kids' mum saying, oh, by the way, I will be taking someone with me, just so that you know. And it's quite an interesting night, actually, because at the end of the performance, both the kids walked straight past their mum, gave me and my partner a hug. And then the mum just kind of took one look at us, stuck her nose up in the air, and then walked off with the kids. Didn't even say hello or anything.
Oh, well, rise above it. Rise above it, I think is the name of the game. There is it. Rise above it. Online versus offline. Should we go back to the future on this? Like, this is a real hot topic at the minute, because some people, you know, online has been a thing for a number of years.
It's pros and cons for a number of years. It's not going away anytime soon, and the future of it scares me to a degree. What's not important is how you meet. What is important that you do meet. And if you want to meet someone offline, that's cool. Go do it. You've just got to get out your house. They're not going to come and knock on the door saying, hey, here I am. They might stick an online profile on, which gives you that awareness. But then, especially for guys, most women are looking for the same kind of guy. That, according to some stats I see, mainly over in the States, probably true here as well, a lot of them are looking for 6 foot tall with a six pack and a six figure income. Hang on a minute, where have we seen 666 before? Anyway.
Isn't that a sign of the devil in carnage?
Yeah. And that's only like the top, 15% of the population? Some of them are going to be married. Some are going to be gay. And a lot of them aren't interested in settling down. So if the younger ones have been seeing those guys online for 10 years, then they get that urge to settle down and have kids. They try and approach those guys like, no, why would I settle down with you? And then they look at other guys then, and they're like, well, if I wasn't good enough for you 10 years ago, why would I be good enough for you now? Goodbye. Mm. So those ladies are going to be a little bit put out. And I've heard a stat somewhere recently that most men don't even lose their virginity till they're nearly 30 now, which is kind of scary.
Yeah, that's definitely the case when we were growing up, that's for sure. yeah, it's a very different world.
Times
now.
Change. Yeah.
To your point, actually, there was a post on Twitter today, and it's someone I follow on Twitter. And they'd been asked for advice, and this was, and I'll read it to you. It's quite interesting. It says, okay, so I really want to be a dad one time. Okay, I'm 37 years old and feel like I don't have much time left. I have trust issues, insecurities, anxiety, and depression. I'm also an overthinker. I really want to be a family man, but with the way women are these days, obviously got an impression from online, I'm scared to even approach a woman. I hate rejection. How do I get over rejection? I hate the way I look. I feel I'll never be good enough for a woman. And my reply was, as a married dad of two, if it were my mate, I'd be encouraging him to get out of his head and into action, because he's basically thinking himself out of the game and writing a story in his head, in inverted commas, the way women are these days. He needs to be mixing with women face to face. Because a lot of these guys, I notice, not just guys that are getting back into the dating market, but so much of what's written online creates this preconception, this story in their head of what women are like. Guys, go and meet real women, not this imaginary story you have in your head. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah. And just to go back to that 666 thing, when I got with my partner, I don't have a six pack. Well, if I do, it's buried in a beer barrel. But and then I didn't have a six figure income. and I'm living in a van, and I've got a crazy ex, and I've got kids. So I've got all of these things that a lot of these websites say is baggage and whatever else and not attractive. Yet here I am. There's this thing that women need to feel safe. It's not just the financial security and safety. It's that emotional safety. When she feels safe, the rest doesn't matter.
I'm glad you said that, because I think that in some respects as well, it may well be that women have come out of previous relationships themselves, whereby it's all been about the money, the guy bringing in X amount of money to sustain a lifestyle and to give them everything they want, when in actual fact, all they want and all their kids want is their husband slash father's presence, which he's not able to give because he's so preoccupied with providing financially and keeping up with the Joneses and all the trappings of the cars and the holidays and all the rest of it and stuff, when actually they just want dad and husband around, fully present.
Yeah, because men have a risk of their career or business becoming a bit of a dividing wedge between him and his partner. Whereas women, a lot of the time, the children can become that dividing wedge between the two of them.
Yeah.
You see it all the time on women's dating profiles. My kids come first and they always will. Okay, so any relationship a man has with you isn't going to matter. Who's going to date you?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of like something I talk about, which is kind of called what I would loosely call parental martyrdom. And I don't know when that kind of came about, but I noticed it, I think certainly in the last few decades. I don't think it was a thing when I was growing up, because I remember my parents and other parents, you know, they would still have lives away from the family, and they'd still, you know, because I remember being left with babysitters and stuff.
They'd get babysitters.
Extended family and stuff and that. Like, my mom and dad, they weren't worried about leaving me with people if they were going out and stuff. And that was a kind of thing growing up in the like 80s. And that did happen. But for some reason, since the 80s, in the last, say, 30 years or so, this notion of I can't leave my kids with a babysitter or a grandparent or, you know, and it's so bloody suffocating to relationships. And it's, and also from what you've said, it's not only suffocating to relationships, it's suffocating to the formation of new relationships as well, by the sounds of things.
Yeah. So if you think about it, when we were growing up or when we were kids, there was no internet. So if somebody's kid got abducted or abused or anything like that, you'd only know about it if it was in your local town, somebody you knew, or in the local paper, or maybe made a national headline. Aside from that, we wouldn't know. Whereas now, everything's all over the internet, and whether it's true, whether it's not.
It's perception, isn't it? Because I remember reading something a couple of years ago that the actual rate of child abductions hasn't changed in the last 30 or 40 years, but it's the perception in the media that has. So like, to your point that you just made just then, there is this perception that kids are getting kidnapped, you know, left, right and centre. But in actual fact, it's the reporting of it, you know, because again, when we were growing up, you had what? You had the morning news, lunchtime news, 6 o'clock news, and what is it, 10 o'clock news. And that was on, you had to be in front of the TV when that was being watched. So it's not like you could watch it on demand or anything. Now we have 24-hour rolling news. So you can get news to your device. So it creates a perception whereby we're actually thinking, I'd love to see the kind of science behind it, what goes on in your brain. But I'm sure that if you're listening to the same story over and over again, the degree to which it ingrained in your subconscious must be higher, because it's repetition, isn't it? Over and over again.
Fear, 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 fear.
Yeah, it's a constant fear.
Yeah, they proved that the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, yeah.
If you, and if I you, won't if you, get into that one.
Yeah, that's the whole podcast itself. But if you want to find out about fear, yeah, check out Laura Dodsworth's book, A State of Fear. That is kind of the, that is the blueprint to how fear is installed in us. But so just finishing off, what are some golden rules when it comes to getting back into the dating game, would you say?
Golden rules. Well, for me, it's not just about in the dating game, it's in life. Number one, know yourself. Number two, be yourself. Number three, stay true to yourself.
I like it. I like it. And what I like about our conversation tonight as well is that so much of this stuff is applicable regardless of whether or not you're getting into a new relationship or whatever. This is stuff you can still do if you're in a relationship, yeah, and you think it might be hitting the rocks, or it could be better, or you could improve things. Because one of the things that, as you know, Alan, that I work with guys on is actually doing some of this work before it gets to the point at which you have to divorce or separate. And this work can be done before it reaches that point in a lot of cases. I mean, you obviously mentioned that your ex-wife was had narcissistic characteristics. A lot of men and women just haven't had any schooling or education in relationship dynamics. And once you begin to understand it, it's like, no, you can't unsee it, can you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, once you get it, it's quite simple. It's not easy, but simple and easy are not the same thing.
Yeah.
But it is fairly simple.
Yeah. And it may take some renegotiation and re-establishing of boundaries and some resetting of your relationship. But the temporary pain of doing a reset has got to be the better than the permanent pain of it falling apart completely. In a lot of cases, I would imagine. So
yeah, it's like, where are we at now? Where do we want this relationship to be in the future?
Mm.
Not an easy conversation to have, but it's easier to have it now than when the divorce solicitors are involved and it's costing £400 or £500 an email.
Yeah, and I think there isn't it. I think there needs to be a growing recognition that actually relationships go through stages, because I think that what people confuse. So you have the honeymoon stage, and then you kind of settle down, and then you kind of go into what I would term the mature stages of a relationship, where you've been together for quite some time. You're probably older as people, your needs may have changed, and the relationship evolves. But I think what often some people do is they confuse that stage with, oh, we've fallen out of love and we've grown apart, when in actual fact, that's quite a normal evolution of long-term relationships.
Masks are falling off.
Yeah.
The masks are falling off, and the crazy kind of thoughts of, oh, this person's absolutely amazing and there's no flaws whatsoever, you start seeing the flaws. And then you think, oh, didn't notice that before. And you, what other flaws have they got? And then you focus on the flaws and that's all you see. But when you actually communicate through them and grow through them together, you come out with a beautiful relationship.
Mm. Yeah. And you're not projecting. You're not projecting.
Chuck away society.
There's not in this infantile projection either that goes on. There's some brilliant books that I read on this, which is James Hollis, Finding Meaning in Midlife, Richard Rohr, Falling Upwards. I think it's also in this one as well, Manhood by Steve Biddulph. And all three of those books written by mature guys talk about this, how you get to this kind of this mature stage of relationships where you're not projecting, where you're accepting them for who they are, where you are embracing your individuality, they're embracing their individuality, you know your faults, your warts and all. And in actual fact, it's actually kind of quite a fun bit to get to. And also as well, and this is going to sound crude, you're not looking at them as a semen receptacle any longer either. Because a lot of guys get their validation through their need to have sex sex with their wives. Oh, I must have sex with my wife. I must have lots of sex with my wife. But in actual fact, you're just it reaches a point where, as a mature man, you're kind of doing this infantile objectification of your wife and using her as a, like I said, a semen receptacle, rather than actually valuing her intrinsic value as a human being and as the woman that you're married to. And again, this, I think it takes a process of maturing as a man to recognize that. That we don't need to get all our validation through feeling wanted and needed and desired by our wives. Actually, we can get those needs met in different ways and different forms, which don't involve her often a lot of the time, being your own man.
So, absolutely.
Alan, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. As always, we follow a lot of the same people and we have a lot of the same information that we've kind of learned from. And it is all learning because like I say, this stuff, we're not always taught this stuff. What is the best way for people to find out about you, link up with you, message you? How do people go about doing that, Alan?
Facebook, LinkedIn, or directly on my website, which is www.theloveengineer.rocks.
Okay. Super. And I'm going to ask you a question that I don't prime any of my guests for. You remember what it is because you've listened to the podcast a few times, but I know that you will have to think about it. Adam, what is it in life that gives you meaning?
What gives me meaning? Well, it's something that evolves as I get older. But at the moment, it's about being authentic, staying true to who I am, and being a great dad, being a great partner, and lots of rock music.
I love that last bit, lots of rock music. And it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I wish you all the best with the work that you're doing, helping people to navigate the world of dating, relationships, and love. And I'll catch you soon, sir.